Tommy, Tom Esker. Tom Esker. And this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Esker, here in the heartland, in the bunker, right here in north central Indiana, transmitting to the world. Terrible Tommy, Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger here in the bunker right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station. And that's right next to our Weapons of Mass Destruction world-renowned used equipment yard. Yeah, pretty much under snow now. Of course, that big stuff we got out there, that big mechanized stuff, there ain't no snow going to cover that up. It gets it up around the tank tracks, but it don't get up any higher, man, I'll tell you. We still got packed snow on our roads out here. All the side roads are all packed, and even some of the main roads. It's mountains of snow everywhere. Where the cities caterpillaring this stuff up in 10, 12, 14. I got a 14-foot pile of snow right out in my parking lot, man. I'm telling you. Looks like a pyramid of Giza. Yeah. Well, I got two cars out of three running fine, but my little truck, I had it sitting in the snow too long, and I'm going to have to thaw that son of a gun out before I drive that thing. Well, hey, it is Wotan's Day, Wednesday, Dave Lane's favorite day, and it is the 8th of January, all day today. We're not getting much sun. It's overcast. I guess they've been chemicalizing the clouds again. It's too bad. Started to melt a little bit around the edges, but we need a lot more sun than we got and a lot lower, higher temperatures. Just try to imagine if you were in the military and you were in combat in this kind of weather with these blizzards and snow and everything. It'd be unbelievably cold and it'd really be rough. And you really couldn't get a hole in the ground and make a foxhole either. The ground's too damn hard, man. Well, these guys that like ice fishing are really having a ball. Man, they're out there on those lakes like you wouldn't believe. Boy, they can have that stuff. I never did get into ice fishing. I saw one on television, a picture of one. Yeah, man, this thing was a regular small house out there on the on the ice. Had a bar in it and had everything in it. Had hoochie coochie girls and everything. It was a party ice building there. That's something else. I've never been in one like that though. Somebody sent me something today, an article, something about Putin. Putin is outing the Jews and pointing his finger at the Jews. Be very cautious about any kind of a deal that Putin's involved in. He's like all politicians. He's playing all sides of the fence. I know the right wing get all excited. Every time a right winger, like over in Europe or something, says one little thing that could be construed as going after the Jews or something like that, they go crazy. Oh, he's our man. He's our leader. We're going to follow him. Well, I see the spin crowd is about to get their comeuppance out there in Las Vegas. North Las Vegas faces financial ruin if a multimillion dollar structural deficit isn't fixed, officials said Tuesday at a special city council meeting. If nothing changes in city revenues and expenses, North Las Vegas could run out of money by late this year or early 2015, said Darren Adar, the city's chief financial officer. Now, where'd all that money go, man? Seemed to me, wasn't North Las Vegas where the blacks lived? I'm not sure. I think it was. That would mean bankruptcy, and the State Department of Taxation would take control of the city's finances. Well, there you go. That's a town where everybody gives and then the Hebe boys take and get out of town and bank it into Cayman Islands. I think they're getting ready to get back into Cuba. What do you think? I think they're going to finally get off this jag about Cuba. And I think the Castros are going to say, come on down here, boys, and get those casinos going again. You wait and see. I don't think it's too far off. And if that happens, of course, they may say, well, Las Vegas, man, you're running out of water. The lakes are going dry, and you know, we got all this problem and this problem. They may start backing off Las Vegas a little bit. I wonder if this is going to happen. Old Snowden says he's got quite a bit more information to put out there, to leak. And Edward Snowden's leak said that the NSA whistleblower still... Oh, that was Greenwald, says that he still has a huge number of very significant stories to reveal, including those relating to Israel. Now, how far do you think he's going to get into that? I wish he'd just blow the whole thing and let her go, get it out there, you know? Quote, there definitely are stories left that involve the Middle East, that involve Israel. The reporting is going to continue at roughly the same pace that it's been happening, the former Guardian journalist said in an interview with Channel 10 television station that aired Monday night. Quote, I don't want to preview any stories that aren't yet published, but it's definitely the case that there are a huge number of very significant stories that are left to report. The Brazil-based Greenwald said, adding that the journalist will continue increasing stories at roughly the same pace that has been happening. Quote, we have only had these documents for 7 months, which, given their volume and complexity, is not a very long time, he quoted. Well, I'm ready to get that stuff on Israel. Get that out there. I don't think it's going to happen, or at least not the real heavy stuff, their connection to Saudi Arabia, all that kind of stuff. But we'll see. We must be optimists. Well, here's the latest from our roving reporter in Las Vegas on the water situation. The sinuous Colorado River and its slew of man-made reservoirs from the Rockies to southern Arizona are being sapped by 14 years of drought, nearly unrivaled in 1,250 years. The once broad and blue river has in many cases dwindled to a murky brown trickle. Reservoirs have shrunk to less than half their capacities. The canyon walls around them ringed with white mineral deposits where water once lapped. Seeking to stretch their allotments of the river, regional water agencies are recycling sewage effluent, offering rebates to tear up grass lawns, and subsidizing less thirsty appliances from dishwashers to shower heads. But many experts believe the current drought is only the harbinger of a new, drier area in which the Colorado flow will be substantially and permanently diminished. And this is happening all over the country. This is not just in Las Vegas. If you think it is, well, you're wrong. Things are getting drier and drier all over the place, and I think there's something to this conversion situation up there, that as the poles warm up, that warm air pushes that, I forget what they call it, and it starts pushing the, changing the route of the airstream. So I think there's something going on there, boys and girls. I'm not the expert, but there's definitely something going on. It's not just a intermittent weather change, I don't think. But whatever is causing it, the point is to look at the results. The results are in. You better start saving your water, man. Faced with the shortage, federal authorities this year will, for the first time, decrease the amount of water that flows into Lake Mead, the nation's largest reservoir, from Lake Powell, 180 miles upstream. That will reduce even more the level of Lake Mead, a crucial source of water for cities from Las Vegas to Los Angeles and for millions of acres of farmland. Reclamation officials say that there is a 50-50 chance that by 2015, Lake Mead's water will be rationed to states downstream. That too has never happened before. If Lake Mead goes below elevation of 1,000, the 1,000 feet above sea level, we lose any capacity to pump water to serve the municipal needs of 7 in 10 people in the state of Nevada, said John Ensteminger, the senior deputy general manager of the Southern Nevada Water District. There you go, boys and girls. We've been talking about it for years, and now they're finally starting to get a little bit excited about it. Well, as these giant metropolises continue to eat up more water, drink up more water, waste more water all over the country, not just in Las Vegas, what do you think is going to happen? Oh, they talk about immigration. Immigration's fine, these social Marxists say. The more the merrier. But every one of them drink and use water. So if we have 20 million illegal aliens and all that in here, they're all drinking water. They're all using oil and gas. You never hear a progressive argue that point and say, wait a minute. We don't have anything against these poor people, but they're drinking all the water. They're consuming lots of things. And, I mean, you know, I can't understand these Harvard-educated progressives that can be so smart about a lot of things, but be so stupid about there's only so much water to go around. And with the weather's climate changes, there are going to be less and less to go around. So if you've got 20 million, maybe it's 30 million, maybe it's 40 million mestizo in here, all drinking water, all using the bathroom. Well, some of them use a can, but and then you got 20 million Negroes. I think I saw that many on TV last night. They're all drinking water. You bring in all these Asians in here. How many? We got 10, 15 million Asians are in here. And then all the white Umermachen, what do you call them? What did Marx call them? Untermachen, I believe it was. People who don't really produce anything, but all they do is consume. Well, we got a lot of white people like that, too. And they're all drinking water and stuff and using the bathroom and driving their cars. Well, it's got to come to a head sometime, gotta come to a head. Well, here's, if it wasn't so sad, it would be funny. As the Iraqi army and al-Qaeda-linked militants battle for control of the city of Fallujah, Senators John the Idiot McCain and Lindsey the Politician Graham are slamming the Obama administration for its Iraq policy. Wait a minute, McCain. Weren't you with the guy named Bush Jr. that declared war without a declaration of war on Iraq? Weren't you into all that stuff? Weren't you supporting going into Afghanistan? And so since he's black and he's a Democrat, they're going to really unload on him. More than 2 years after the administration failed to reach a status of forces agreement with Iraq and withdrew all American combat troops from the country, the two senior Republican senators are blaming President Barack Obama for the violence erupting there this week. Now, how could that be? Now, let's be fair, boys. Let's be a little fucking fair here. We want all the troops out of the Middle East. I do. That's my opinion. And this old bastard McCain, who I despise, he's on my list of people that's despised, is jumping all over Obama. Gonna put it all on the nigger. Hey, you nigger, you caused all the problems. Quote, while many Iraqis are responsible for this strategic disaster, the administration cannot escape its share of the blame. Well, why? People wanted the troops out of Iraq, and he's bringing them out. What the hell could he do? I mean, you know, let's face it. I'm not sure not an Obama fan, but what the hell could he do? He got bringing them out. And you knew exactly what would happen because it's unconventional warfare. And like I said before, the guerrillas always win if they fight long enough. So they just wait. We had to bring the troops out sometime. Of course, we never should have had them there in the first place. And when they come out, all the boys, all the old scores are going to be settled. So there's nothing you can do about it. That's just nature. They said, when President Obama withdrew all U.S. forces from Iraq in 2011 over the objections of our military leaders and commanders on the ground, well, you're not paying the fucking bill, you guys. Many of us predicted that the vacuum would be filled by America's enemies. Well, I don't think you had so many enemies when Saddam Hussein was in power over there in Iraq. I don't remember Iraq attacking us. I don't remember Iraq killing American citizens. I don't remember that. But now they will, all the time. Yeah. And would emerge as a threat to the U.S. national security interests. Here you go. Well, always color that corporate interests. Not national security interests, corporate and banking interests. Sadly, that reality is now clearer than ever, said McCain of Arizona and Graham of South Carolina in a statement. McCain, why don't you crawl in a hole and die, man? I wish you'd sit on a scorpion down there in Arizona and let him crawl right up your butt and then sting you. He is a real unclass act. And our person who sent us this says, this is simply amazing. McCain and Graham are actually criticizing the ending of the Iraq occupation, which cost this country billions of dollars and thousands of lives. Yeah. Yeah, and there should be people marching in the street and burning these people in effigy. I mean, can you believe how crazy, how stupid, how insane this all is? We bomb and occupy and kill thousands of people that had nothing to do with 9/11. Absolutely nothing. And Saddam Hussein was a dictator, but it was a well-run dictatorship. They had a high education level of women and men. none of these wacko Islamic radicals were allowed to get out of hand. He kept them at bay. So, oh no, we got to get rid of him because he's a threat to the USA. Boy, I'll tell you. You got to have wings to stay above the bullshit. That was one of my favorite sayings from Apocalypse Now. The crap's so deep, you got to have wings to stay above it. What's amazing is the general population lets them get away with it. I mean, they're not doing anything. You hear a few talk show people, a few of the left talking about it. But the Jew left, they think things are fine. And the right wing, the only thing they're upset is that there may be some peace erupt in the world. The Republicans want, there may be some peace, and the Republicans are pissed. The people behind the Republican Party are not going to make as much money building arms. It's very simple. The solution is very simple, too, but no one wants to do it. And we don't have the power or strength to do it, that's for sure. Well, this is a pretty neat story. I sent along to you the long, long part of it. Here in Germany, the so-called neo-Nazis, of course, you know that anybody that's a nationalist or anything, conservative or anything, they're all neo-Nazis. They've got one term for everybody, so whatever that means, neo-Nazi, who knows. But anyhow, they're getting press cards. They've gotten smart, and they've gotten themselves in a position of getting press cards so they can gain access to these big meetings, media pools, where they can take pictures and all that kind of stuff. The media, of course, and the media is crying their eyes out because they're saying, oh, they're just there to take our pictures and threaten us and intimidate us. Bullshit. They want to be in on talking to these big shots in the interviews and all that kind of stuff. Of course they do. And that's one of the first smart things I've seen anybody who was labeled a neo-Nazi do lately. You know, I had a she-wolf contact me the other day and said, you know what, Tom? You look at all these skinheads that are rolling over on their buddies and doing crazy things and getting into drug gangs and then they're writing books, you know, whining about, oh, they never should have got involved in it and all that. Well, 15 years ago, people forget what I say 15 years ago. I told the skinheads it's time to put it to bed. It's over. It's time to put it to bed. You should cut your hair, or I mean, let your hair grow out. Get a good job. Go to school. Go to college. Get rid of the skinhead motif and the whole bit. And then get out in society in the various areas where you can get professional work, whether it's civilian or military or police or whatever, and then you could be very important to us. And a lot of them did, and I know quite a number of them myself that did that, because they every once in a while will contact me and tell me how they're doing, and many of them have nice families and the whole bit. They got the message. But there are certain leaders in this country that have kept promoting the skinhead scene long after it should have been put to bed, and one of the reasons was to sell a lot of music. Of course, for a while there, that Oi music was pretty hot among a certain percentage of white youth, but it lost its popularity pretty fast. There's still some people out there selling the CDs and things like that. But it's just like Robert Miles said to me years ago, it was time to put the Klan to bed. There was nothing more to be gained by having the KKK. Then it just became the whipping boy for the media and everybody else. And then you had the same situation with every little punk in town wanting to either burn a 3-foot cross on some black's yard or painting KKK on the side of a building. And the National Socialists, so-called, the Hollywood Nazis, are the same thing. They degenerated into really nothing, but still causing problems that are certainly not doing the racial cause any good in the long run. And so the skinheads, now, you know, we even got their skinhead, hardcore, drug trafficking, gun shooting skinheads out there claiming to be white power or whatever, but they're doing the things that we were 100% against. So, but the press love it. They love to keep it alive, just like any little thing that some guy who says, "I'm the grand poopah of the KKK," does. They're going to follow him all day long to get a story, and they know what they're doing, promoting all the bad image of the KKK and the National Socialists, and the stupider the representative is, the better. So, I don't know. There's not much we can do to get around it. It's just going to take time. But in the meantime, you're going to see these guys, and they're going to be involved with the skinhead thing or something for maybe a year or so, and then all of a sudden they get in trouble, and then they apologize, and then they write a book about how it was horrible that these people talked them into getting into the skinhead thing and become a racist. Now I've seen the light, and now I'm going to tour the country giving speeches for Morris Dees and the Holocaust Museum or whoever. So that's the way it goes, and there's not much can be done about it until there's a power center that can get the message across to certain people just to cease and desist. I know they gather around Stormfront in these outfits like bees to honey, and the chat boards are full of these people, and some of them are headed for prison again, or yet, or still, and some of them are just going to be troublemakers from here on out until they finally quit and find something else to do. They're here in Indiana, too. They're around. I hear little bits and pieces. They're not going to come around me because I'm going to tell them to probably quit doing what they're doing and do something that's productive. I was contacted by one who evidently immigrated from down south over to a town that's just a few miles from me, and he wanted to get together, and when I explained through the email how we operated, well, that was the end of that. He didn't want any part of that. He wanted rallies and music concerts, and he wanted to get those niggers and everything, get out on the street, and oh, God. So that's the last I heard of that one. So, Miss She-Wolf, you're exactly right, and it's something we're going to have to live with because the press will never let it turn around, and they'll always use it against us. Well, here's something that most people don't want to hear, but it's got a lot of truth to it. The political scatology, which is Mitt Romney's willful and racist lie that President Obama wants to end welfare reform and give free money to all those lazy black and brown human parasites that want to live off the white people, has attracted some flies. Well, you know, and I know, that Obama is not interested in the rank and file Negro, the working class Negro, or the parasite Negro. He identifies with the rich, the powerful, the corporates, and most of them are white and Jewish. He's got no time for this kind of stuff. The media spins its wheels debating the role of racial dog whistle politics by Republicans in their hostility and opposition to the country's first black president. Well, they're not as opposed to the black president as they are to his way of doing things. The Republicans are such hypocrites. as opposed to calling out Mitt Romney for the racist liar that he has proven himself to be. Well, all politicians are liars. Black politicians are racist liars, too. So what's new? The central element of dog whistle politics is that the cues are so subtle and coded that only the target audience will pick up on a given speaker's real intent. Well, you're saying the public is stupid? Well, of course the public is stupid. Ostensibly, these secret code signals give a politician plausible deniability, where in Romney's case and the Republican Party en masse, racism can be denied. But yes, yeah, I say, yeah, they use it. They use it all the time, code words and everything else. And then they stand back and deny it, and they're the first ones that want to hang a real racist for telling the truth. And then the assertion flipped in a game of political acadu that plays on white victimology and the spurious claims of reverse racism. Well, there is victimology, and whites have claim to, white working class have claims to a lot of white victimology. And they're not spurious claims to talk about reverse racism, because if you look at TV nowadays, you're seeing almost 50% blacks on TV. And you're going to see more and more in the movies. It's reverse racism. The powers that be will throw the blacks a few bones. Not anything that's going to lift them out of their poverty, anything like that, but to make them feel better. You know, we got a black president and he's taking care of things. Bullshit. I don't think most black people believe that. In theory, those candidates that deploy racial dog whistles can win both ends of the deal. You're right. They use it all the time. And the right-wing racial element of this struggle fall for it every time. The whole goddamn Duke, Stormfront, all that stuff. They fall for it. The conservative right wing. They get to communicate their onerous message. This same candidate then mines white racial resentment for the electoral gain when they are critiqued for their racism. You see, this is written by an anti-racist, but there's a lot of truth in it. Romney and his defenders will continue. This may have been written before he ran for president, or when he ran for president, I'm not sure. Romney and his defenders will continue to deny the obvious racial invective in the Barack Obama is a welfare king ad. However, there's one group of people who hear Romney's racial appeals crystal clear and in stereo. As I discuss this post, I do a daily survey of some of the most prominent white supremacist websites. The views expressed in the white nationalist online community are the racial ID of contemporary populist conservatism in the age of Obama. Well, it doesn't fit me, I'll tell you that. As such, these spaces are a telling barometer for the backstage and front stage racism of the new right in the Tea Party GOP. Well, the GOP and the Tea Party is a great one, a very great enemy of our cause. We know, right, where most social Marxist Democrats are standing. They're easy to spot. But these Republicans and this Tea Party bullshit that's being financed by two of the richest men in the country. Here's a featured essay on Mitt Romney's candidacy and his welfare queen, Mimi, from one of the more respectable white nationalist neo-Confederate websites. Huh. Don't say which one it comes from, though. Mitt Romney was in a Chicago suburb today speaking to white voters, blasting the Obama campaign for dismantling welfare reform. So Mitt Romney is speaking to our people, promoting popular issues with subtle and not so subtle racial themes. Yeah, that's what they like to do. They don't have the balls to come out and say what needs to be said. They'd even be respected more by blacks if they did. Again, I note that Mitt Romney is a racial pussyfooter, very similar to George H.W. Bush Sr. U.S. president from 88 to 92, pussyfooters are the most common American racial renegades. Pussyfooters look and act white. They marry white. They don't have any real hatred towards our or their white American people. But they rarely, if ever, defend our people in live or die racial conflicts. Racially charged political campaigns, they pussyfoot around. They try to pretend that there aren't any racial conflicts and any racial problems or some misunderstanding. Pussyfooters like to be liked, and they tend to agree with whoever is in the room with them. This is absolutely correct. You know, a lot of these social Marxists, they could see it. It's very clear to them, and it's clear to me too. You didn't see me coming out with this gigantic Obama's a nigger program. I mean, you know, I mentioned it once in a while. I mean, you know, but and I didn't say everything he did was wrong either. I think you're talking about blacks here, targeting our people, our voters, quote, hunting where the ducks are. The Romney campaign is no longer pandering to NW voters who will never vote for white Republicans. I guess you're talking about blacks. Instead, the Romney campaign is connecting with the voters he and we need to win, and the Romney campaign is standing up for the legitimate rights of our people. You're talking about black people. Well, what Romney and none of the Republican Party wanted to admit is if they could get the people off their ass that didn't even register to vote, the whites that weren't even registering to vote, they would have won the campaign, the last two campaigns, hands down. But they're afraid of the white working class. They know there's still enough anger, still enough potential in the white working class that could kick their ass really good. We are a threat. Collectively, we are a threat. And that's why they're playing the game the way they're playing it. And they're playing, of course, Russian roulette. And the slug's going to come around pretty soon on them. When Whitey's had enough, we know what you're doing. You ain't bullshitting us no more. Yeah, right. That's the way it goes. Well, as far as I'm concerned, as a white person, the fact that Romney didn't win was because he was a wuss. He had no working class attraction at all. I wouldn't want anybody like that to buy me a drink in a bar. I mean, I don't want anything to do with it. One Mary had a bunch of kids, I'd think, well, is this guy a fag or isn't he? He acted like a fag. Anyhow, that's another reason why lots of white people didn't vote for him. He came across as a jerk, a wealthy jerk. And he didn't know the difference between shit and shinola, unless some Jew told him. You know, you can see a lot of this kind of stuff on the Fox TV, how they will so-called pander to the blacks and stuff like that, but it's limp-wristed pandering. And it's sad to actually watch these people perform, because they hate the neo-Nazis, and anything racial is absolute. This is horrible. We love the black people and all that, and you know, the unwashed out there see right through it. And then social Marxists hate Fox's guts, and they should hate their guts, because they're such liars and cheats. That they have this 5 on at 5 o'clock every day, and they have all these mannequin girls on there, and couple of guys and a Jew comedian and like that, and one sort of a progressive, and it's like watching a goddamn circle jerk. And but they love the Mexicans, they love the blacks. Yeah, you'll never convince them of that. The guy that wrote what I just read part of, his name is Chauncey DeVega. He says, I am an editor and founder of We Are Respectable Negroes. I'm also a race man in progress, black pragmatist, ghetto nerd, cultural critic, and essayist. I have been a guest on BBC, Ring of Fire Radio, Ed Schultz, Joshua Holland's Alternate Radio Hour, Tom Hartman Radio Show, and Bert Cohen's Show, and Our Common Ground. Well, these are all social Marxist programs. He would be welcome. My essays have been featured by Salon, Alternet, and the New York Daily News, and the Daily Kos, all social Marxist. But even so, there's a hell of a lot of truth in what he's talking about. This filthy Republican Party. I despise the Republican Party more even than the Democrat Party, because the Democrat, I just write them off as Looney Tunes nowadays. They're not leaning towards the working class at all. They're in the same pocket, only they're Me Too. They're Me Too. But the Republican Party, these sons of bitches, the quicker we can get rid of the Republican Party, the better we're all going to be. And don't you realize that we didn't have the Republican Party in the game? We could take the gloves off with these bastards and either have third parties or whatever, or movements or people marching in the streets and raising hell or whatever. As long as the Republican Party's there, we're going to continue to lose, lose, lose. Because they're the property party. That's all they care about. Is bottom line is money, greed, corporate power. That's it. Nothing else matters. Fuck everything. Fuck the environment. Fuck it all. Just keep the money rolling in, baby. That's why you should despise the Republican Party, too. I don't know how many of you remember the Everly Brothers like I do. They were big in the mid-50s, and then they went in the Marine Corps and so forth. But a lot of top singers said that, well, let me read this to you. I found this in a little corner of the web. I'm not going to pretend that I'm capable of writing the definitive or the most comprehensive Phil Everly obituary. Evidently, he died, and I'm not sure quite on what date. There are a lot of remembrances already out there, and plenty of rock historians who can tell you much more about the Everly's place in musical history than I ever could. But what I can offer is my favorite Everly story, one regarding perhaps the most brilliant song that Everly never wrote. In an interview with the Wall Street Journal published in June 2013, he talks about his beautiful house outside Nashville, Tennessee in Maury County. It was built in 1846 and has this unique bit of history to it, according to Everly. During the Civil War, a famous Confederate lieutenant general named Nathan Bedford Forrest had a violent argument with a lieutenant named A. Willis Gould. Words were exchanged. Gould shot Forrest in the hip, and Forrest wounded, fatally stabbing the other guy, Gould. Forrest recuperated in our bedroom. I suppose there's a song in that story someplace. See, the Everly Brothers bought this house. They lived in it for a long time, I guess. I'm not sure if Forrest's ghost is hanging around, but I have a theory about this house. It won't let you do anything to the structure it doesn't like. We had a roof leak a few years back, and a carpenter impulsively wanted to solve the problem by drilling a hole in the floor, but the bit snapped right off. The house wouldn't let him do it. This kind of thing has happened several other times. For the record, Forrest died in Memphis, Tennessee, but let's just say it's plausible that this Confederate ghost could find its way back to this estate. The idea for Nathan Bedford Forrest's death match, freaky haunted house country rock song, is even more interesting when you consider that Forrest was also the first Grand Dragon of the KKK, the namesake of Forrest Gump, and an accused war criminal. Under Forrest's command, Confederate troops carried out the atrocity at Fort Pillow, where hundreds of surrounded black soldiers were slaughtered. Well, that's a lie, because he was exonerated for that. He gave everybody a chance to give up, whether they were white or black. And so if they were shot down, it had nothing to do with them being black. A congressional investigation cleared Forrest of that. So who knows if he was being serious about this song? I hope so, since it would make for a terrific song. Sadly, it seems that Everly never got around to writing and recording it. But what he accomplished in life was, of course, already way more than enough. Some of the greatest rock music of the 60s would not have sounded the way it did if it weren't for Phil and Don Everly. That's a hell of a legacy to leave behind. Interesting piece of trivia. I was a fan of the Everly Brothers, and I had one of their first big albums that showed them both on a big old Harley Davidson panhead. In black and white. That was before they went into the Marine Corps. After that, their careers slipped quite a bit. I lost track of them. But in closing the show, I'll play you one of their songs in case you don't know who they are. You young people, I'm sure, don't know who they are. Well, do we have a man's army anymore or a sex crime army? With a single star studding on each shoulder of his immaculate blues, Brigadier General Jeffrey A. Sinclair waited his turn to go through the metal detectors at the federal courthouse at Fort Bragg, just like everyone else. He smiled broadly at one of the armed military police officers posted at the door and asked, "How many jumps do you have?" I imagine the guy was thinking, do you mean on women or little kids? The young soldier, wearing the wings of a paratrooper with the elite 82nd Airborne, stood a little straighter as he confidently answered, 28. Sinclair nodded in approval, not mentioning the 217 jumps listed in his own log. After a few more pleasantries, Sinclair put his arm around the man and smiled again as another MP snapped a cell phone photo. Well, and that he's being charged with, what was it now? He appears to be the highest ranking officer ever charged with sex crimes, sexual assault. Sinclair, 51, has pleaded not guilty to 8 criminal charges, including forcible sodomy, indecent acts, violating orders, and conduct unbecoming of an officer. He faces a maximum sentence of life in prison and a court-martial, scheduled to begin on March 3rd. While he denies the most serious allegation that he physically forced a female captain under his command to perform oral sex, shades of Bill Clinton, the married father of 2 concedes he carried on a 3-year extramarital affair with his junior officer. The admission alone will almost certainly end his 28-year Army career, as adultery is a crime under military law. Well, I doubt whether he had to force too much in that situation, but that's just my opinion. I just think that probably the woman has sour grapes because he wouldn't run off to Tahiti and marry her. But I don't want to be called a male chauvinist pig again. Well, I have a question, and I probably have the answer too. Why are U.S. Special Operations Forces deployed in over 100 countries? Quote, "Dude, I don't need to play these stupid games. I know what you're trying to do," unquote, with that Major Matthew Robert Buchholz, hung up on me, this reporter. More than a month before, I had called U.S. Special Operations Command, SOCOM, with a series of basic questions. In how many countries were U.S. Special Forces, Operation Forces, deployed in 2013? Our manpower levels set to expand to 72,000 in 2014? Is SOCOM still aiming for the growth rates of 3% to 5% per year? How many training exercises did the command carry out in 2013? Basic stuff. And for a month, this reporter waited for answers. I called, I left messages, I emailed, I waited some more. I started to get the feeling that Special Operations Command didn't want me to know what its Green Berets and Rangers, Navy SEALs, and Delta Force Commandos, the men who operate the hottest of the hotspots and the most remote locales around the world, were doing. Then at the last moment, just before my filing deadline, Special Operations Command got back to me with an answer so incongruous, confusing, and contradictory that I was glad I had given up on SOCOM and tried to figure things out for myself. I started with a blank map and quickly turned into a global pincushion. It didn't take long before every continent but Antarctica was bristling with markers indicating Special Operations Forces missions, deployments, and interactions with foreign military forces in 2012 to 2013. With that, the true size and scope of the U.S. military's secret military began to come into focus. It was, to say the least, vast. A review of open source information reveals that in 2012 and 2013, U.S. Special Operations Forces, SOF, were likely deployed to or training, advising, or operating with the personnel of more than 100 foreign countries. And that's probably an undercount. In 2011, when SOCOM spokesman Colonel Tim Nye told Tom Dispatch that special operations personnel were annually sent to 120 countries around the world. They were in, that is, about 60% of the nations on the planet were deployed in a number of locations, unquote, was as specific as Buchholz would ever get when he talked to him in the waning days of 2013. And when SOCOM did finally get back to me with an 11th-hour answer, the number offered made almost no sense. Despite the lack of official cooperation, analysis of the Tom Dispatch reveals SOCOM to be a command on the make with an already sprawling reach. As Special Operations Command Chief Admiral William McRaven put it in SOCOM 2020, his blueprint for the future, it is ambitious aspirations to create a global SOF network of like-minded interagency allies and partners. Oh, the empire! Oh, the empire grows bigger all the time. In other words, in that future now, only 6 years off, it wants to be everywhere all the time. Wow. Well, the rise of the military secret military, born of a failed 1980 raid to rescue American hostages in Iran, in which 8 U.S. service members died, long forgotten. U.S. Special Operations Command was established in 1987, made up of units from all service branches. SOCOM is tasked with carrying out Washington's most specialized secret missions. Might as well say predatory capitalist missions, including assassinations, counter-terrorist raids, special reconnaissance, unconventional warfare, psychological operations, foreign troop training, and weapons of mass destruction counter-proliferation operations. In post-9/11 era, the command has grown steadily with about 33,000 personnel in 2001. It is reportedly on track to reach 72,000 in 2014. About half this number are called, in the jargon of the trade, badged operators, SEALs, Rangers, Special Operation Aviators, Green Berets, while the rest are support personnel. Funding for the command also jumped exponentially as SOCOM's baseline budget tripled to $2.3 billion to $6.9 billion between 2001 and 2013. If you add supplemental funding, it has actually more than quadrupled to $10.4 billion. Not surprisingly, personnel deployments abroad skyrocketed from 4,900 man-years, as the command puts it, in 2001 to 11,500 in 2013. About 11,000 special operators are now working abroad in any one time and any day. They are in 70 to 80 countries, though the New York Times reported that according to statistics provided to them by SOCOM during 1 week in March 2013, that number reached 92 countries. Well, so nothing's going to really happen big time until we run out of credit, run out of money. Now, some say that they'll never run out of credit, but there's got to be a reaction to all this, a growing reaction worldwide. the haves against the have-nots. That's interesting. What do you think? I'll send you the whole article.
We'd like to slow the tempo down just a little bit and do a ballad. We do hope you remember it, one called All I Have to Do Is Dream.
Trouble is
do a more recent record. We do hope you enjoy one called Kathy's Clown.
And that's the way it was in the '50s.